As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, speaking in Zoom conference with the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. Tim, how's it going?
I'm no longer on the line. I'm in a Zoom conference.
I decided to be more specific. We are in Zoom conference.
That is the story of all of our lives, isn't it? We're always in Zoom conference.
I'm so very done with Zoom conferences, but that's another story. The Mets have a full-blown winning streak going. Matt Harvey made his return to Flushing. We have a good question about the Mets broadcast team, and we will get to all of that. But first, I want to talk about something you mentioned on Twitter during Wednesday's game. That's the one Harvey started for the Orioles, which was that the Mets went 7-for-10 with runners in scoring position in that game. And I recall all sorts of concern about the Mets hitting with runners in scoring position and an epidemic on the team that seemed to have no cure.
Yeah, it's amazing that things can change in small samples. The Mets, it was kind of the old proverbial death by paper cuts for Harvey. A lot of just singles strung together by the Mets. They didn't hit a home run, right? I'm not making that up.
The deepest ball
was Kevin Pillar's triple, I believe. So they just kind of pieced together a pair of three-run rallies against him in the second and fifth innings. And it was coming through with base hits through the hole, base hits that were drawn in infield to plate runs. It was obviously a baseball game has not played out that way since the second half of the 2015 season. So it was interesting to see up close and in person a team get multiple hits with runners in scoring position and none of them being home runs.
Now for the season, the Mets have a .238 team batting average. They're hitting .233 with runners in scoring position. So ever so slightly worse, but just basically a meaningless difference. That doesn't sound great. Until you consider that the National League on the season is hitting .234 and .237 with runners in scoring position. The difference between the 2021 New York Mets and an average National League team hitting with runners in scoring position would be one single hit. If they had one more hit, they would have the league average batting average with runners in scoring position.
So it has started to balance out during this seven-game winning streak. They're hitting 314 with runners in scoring position. The 7-for-10 does have a way of overbearing that a little bit because it was 250 going into that game. They were 15-for-60 in the six-game winning streak. Now they're 22-for-70. Looks a lot better. But that's kind of how this goes. Like, in general, you give a team enough time, it is going to perform with runners in scoring position similarly to how it performs in general. It was weird because the Mets had a 60-game season that feels like a bigger chunk of time because it was the entire season last year in which they didn't. Although even then, they were much better in the second half of that season with runners in scoring position than they were in the first. And then you had a similar thing happen in the first month of this season. But my chief concern about this Mets roster moving forward would not be their ability to hit with runners in scoring position.
And the poster boy for those struggles, Michael Conforto, is now on the season batting .321 with runners in scoring position. He's 9-for-28.
Well, he's got to do it in games when they don't win 7-2, right? He's got to come up with some more walk-off fielder's choice hits, walk-off fielder's choices like Patrick Mazzica. Then Michael Conforto can be a hero.
The great Patrick Mazzica. I'm rooting for this guy to have a major league career, but I don't know. There's some romance to the idea of Nimmo comes back from the DL and Mazzica is dispatched and we never really hear from him again. And he's just this magical figure of weird clutch performance.
The Athletic's oral history of Patrick Mazzica's week in the big leagues 10 years from now would be well read, I think. You hope that this is just the start for him, that he does get a hit and stays with the club for a while, and that the Mets never lose a game when he's on the roster, because he's the guy who came up between games of the doubleheader in St. Louis. They won the second game, his first game on the roster, and they have not lost since.
7 in a row, which we pointed out, I think we agreed in the last podcast, was the benchmark for making Ratcoon a thing. And now the winning streak did start, I think it slightly predated the Ratcoon, but now we can say this is a rat or raccoon driven winning streak.
And unfortunately, now that they're going on the road for a while, it's a three city road trip for them. They won't get to throw scoreboard graphics up there. They can't show. It does give, I guess, the Citi Field scoreboard crew some time to create some sort of animated rat/raccoon that they can show in the later innings to get the crowd going. You've got a week and a half to come up with something good for when they come home against Colorado at the end of May.
So I'm interested because you're saying that. And you had framed it this way earlier as a ratcoon thing, but I was wondering if really there's some energy in the rat or raccoon debate, if you could identify one as the good thing, which is tough with those two particular creatures, right? But if it was is this inning going to be a rat or a raccoon? And the raccoon is preferable, right? You'd rather have a raccoon issue than rats, I think. I don't know. I haven't thought this all the way through.
Yeah, maybe they can team up, they work together to solve problems and fight crime and solve mysteries or something. I think there's a bigger idea here than just scoreboard graphics, now that I think about it.
And of course, eat garbage.
Right.
They do both eat garbage. That's something rats and raccoons very much have in common. Let's look at the standings a little bit now, and obviously it's early. It's we're not even at Memorial Day. I tend to just discount the standings or ignore them altogether until we get into June a little bit. If you look around the league, there's certainly other surprises. The Red Sox are leading the AL East. I don't think anyone expects that to last all season. The Giants are leading the NL West. I don't think anyone expects that to last all season. I would take with a grain of salt the fact that the Mets are now a game up on the Phillies in the National League East, several games up in the win, in the loss column, owing to not having played a bunch of games at the beginning of the year. But the Braves are struggling a little bit, and I think that's the team that everyone would have identified at the outset of the season as the Mets' sort of primary opponent for the NL East title.
Yeah, they're pitching outside of really, Ian Anderson and Waskar Inoa. Inoa's been basically their ace and one of their best hitters also, because he's got a pair of home runs, including a monster grand slam for them. But guys like Charlie Morton and Drew Smyly have not pitched well. Max Fried is carrying an ERA over 6. So those guys haven't pitched well. And then their bullpen has not been the strength that it was last year. They let Mark Melancon go. They brought back Chris Martin, but he's been hurt. Now they're bringing back Shane Green. And then the worst news for them of late is that Mike Soroka, the guy who was their best pitcher in 2019, And Mets fans remember him tearing his Achilles against the Mets in 2020, that he needs exploratory surgery to see what's going on with his Achilles, which is, if you're asking me, like the types of surgery I would least want to undergo, after I would say all of them, I would say something like exploratory surgery to see what's going on with my Achilles, because
it doesn't make it sound like you're going to pitch in a major league game anytime soon.
Right. And you know, he's had some shoulder issues already in his attempt to come back. Like, it, you know, at the start of the season, they were saying that the idea was that Soroka would be back, you know, by now, basically late April, mid-May, you know, draft him in your fantasy leagues, as maybe some of the hosts of this podcast did. Now it looks much murkier for him coming back at some point this season. And that changes the complexion of what the Braves rotation can be, because, maybe Freed, Smiley, Morton pitch better, but that probably gets evened out by someone like Enoa not carrying a 2.2 ERA for very much longer.
I think also, though, that we have to say, like, some of the Braves have just underperformed, right? Like, Freddie Freeman hasn't hit like Freddie Freeman yet. And the lineup outside of Ronald Acuña Jr. has been typically excellent. Like, the lineup hasn't really clicked to date. I would still say, and maybe you disagree with me, that despite the Phillies having played better now, as a Mets fan, I'm still more concerned about the Braves than I am any other team in this division.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that, because their offense, you know, Ozuna has not hit much at all at this point in the season. Even Ozzie Albies hasn't played very well. You know, it's weird because we haven't seen the Braves up close. We've seen a lot of the Phillies so far this year. So you get more familiar with the Phillies' flaws and what you think is fixable and what's not. And their bullpen and the back end of their rotation do not seem like they would hold up over the course of the full season.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that offense is very good, especially in the middle of the order. And Atlanta's offense, which should be that good in the middle of the order, just hasn't performed that way to this point.
Yeah, I think that is fair. And I think that, like, maybe there's, I don't know, as a, for whatever reason, I think possibly due to the fact that I know a lot of people who live in Washington, D.C., I find myself especially rooting against the Nationals. And it is comforting to see them sort of falling to the bottom of the division so early.
Yeah, that offense was the concern. You know, after you let Harper and Rendon go, you're really building around Soto and Turner. And the people they've
and
brought
Turner's
in.
Turner's been great. Like, Turner's been great.
Yeah, Turner's been great. Soto, when he's played, you know, he missed some time, but has been really good, if not, like, as insanely good as he was last year. But I didn't love the bringing in Josh Bell. You know, Schwarber, I thought, would be hitting better than he is so far. He's under 200. But Bell has been has given them almost nothing so far at first base. You know, they've been playing Ryan Zimmerman a fair amount there, and he's playing better. But that lineup is just awfully shallow once you get past Soto and Turner. And it's the same, you know, the rotation, it really needs Scherzer, Strasburg, and Corbin to be really good. And Scherzer's the only one in that group living up to the bargain so far. So it's, you know, it's like those old Tigers rosters that, you know, where it was so top heavy. It was like you had Miguel Cabrera and Prince Fielder in the lineup and not much after that. And then you had like three or in some cases four really good starters and no real bullpen. That's what the Nationals feel like to me. And it's even shallower than those teams. Obviously, those Tigers teams are pretty good. It's hard to see it holding up over 162, especially when those pitchers are older. Like, sure, you know, are in their 30s, it's tougher to imagine them carrying a team the way they did in 2019 for Washington.
Yeah, Strasburg did throw a simulated game this week and seems to be close to returning, but the injury is shoulder inflammation, which always feels sort of concerning. And then, you know, I mean, if you look at the line on him, he only pitched two games in 2020, only two games so far this year. He hasn't been Steven Strasburg since 2019. And so I think it's reasonable to wonder how much of Strasburg will be back when he does return to the Nationals. And it definitely colors the future of the season for that team.
Can I say something ridiculous?
Yes.
I think the Marlins might be a bigger threat than like the Nationals at this point. Because you look at Miami, like, for, you know,
I can't agree because, like, I've never heard of half the Marlins.
The Mets finally, with their win on Wednesday, crossed into positive run differential territory. But for the longest time, the Marlins were the only team in the National League East with a positive run differential. And if you look at, like, deeper peripheral statistics, like base runs and, like, second-order winning percentage and things like that, you know, Miami was playing the best in the National League by those metrics. I guess the Mets were better on base runs. Miami was second. But still, you know, like, 10th in all Major League Baseball, even as they were in last in the National League East. You look at that roster, and that's, you know, they're missing some important pieces offensively. Like, their offense just doesn't have enough when they're missing Jazz Chisholm and Starling Marte. But that pitching staff.
Yeah, pitching's good.
Sandy Alcantara, Trevor Rogers has been outstanding. Mm-hmm. Pablo Lopez is a guy that I really like as a pitcher. I think is kind of an underrated guy. And then if I don't know what Sixto Sanchez's injury prognosis is. That's another player that a host of this podcast may have drafted in his fantasy baseball team and is still waiting for. But if he's able to come back within some reasonable amount of time, you've also got Eliezer Hernandez on the IL. If those guys come back and make that a 1-5 rotation, that's a pretty good team. They've gotten some nice bullpen work so far in the after moving on from Anthony Bass as closer. Like, this is a team that I think is probably closer to being good than we're used to thinking. Even after a year where they made the playoffs last year, it seemed kind of fluky given how many roster changes they made and the shortened season. But right now, like, I believe more in the 2021 Marlins, for instance, than I ever did in the 2020 Marlins. And I think they can be, if not a team that wins the division, maybe a team that finishes over 500 in a way that I would not have suspected coming into the year.
Yeah, it's a good point. And the bullpen you mentioned has been great. And I think that what defies expectation a little bit with the Marlins bullpen is that they're not big names, but it is an experienced group. It is like a group that has had some major league success. A bunch of them. Yimi Garcia was good with the Dodgers. Adam Simber has had some big years. Dylan Floro has been good. John Curtis was good with the Rays last year. So I don't know. It's a group you think, like, maybe that's for real. Maybe I think that's a good point. I think that if the Marlins stay healthy, it feels like a team that doesn't have the depth to really hold up and or at least withstand injuries like some of the ones they've already had. But if they happen to have the everything stays right and you know, the team stays healthy season, maybe they could make a run at the division. It seems unlikely, but hey, you know, they're moving in the right direction pretty decidedly, which has not been the case for the Marlins for really most of their existence.
Yeah, I think at the very least they make those 19 games that the Mets have against them, and I think it's what, 16 more or 17 more, because I forget who they got rained out against all those games. It makes those games a bit more difficult. You know, you can't think you're going to go 14-5 in those games or something like that. It's probably going to be closer to, you know, you hope to go like 11-8 against a good team. I do love that Ross Detweiler is in the Marlins bullpen, because I had to be like, that is the same Ross Detweiler,
yeah,
right? That it's not a new Ross Detweiler. And I was surprised that I did not realize that he'd been kicking around the American League the last few years with the White Sox and A's and Mariners and a few different squads.
I'll tell you what else about the Marlins. Their current hat and uniform has grown on me. When they first revealed that, I was like, that is the most generic looking thing. It looks like, if someone pointed out, it looked like a team on a video game that doesn't have MLB licensing. And I thought that sounded right. And then just over time, like every time I see it, it's like, hey, that's not so bad. It's kind of like it's got a sort of a sleek, understated appeal.
Yeah, I still miss I think they should prioritize teal or the electric blue. You know, it's still not the uniform it should be.
Of course not. But, you know, I don't know. You got to take – it's better than the one they rolled out when they rolled out Jose Reyes and Carlos Lee, like the one that kind of looked like a fast food logo, the big N.
Yeah. That was the worst of the Marlins looks. I miss the old, like, gray uniforms that they had with Florida across that they almost never wore, because they always wore the black jerseys tops because they won the World Series in those.
Right.
But the Marlins have like almost have barely ever worn a gray uniform since like 2003. But those were the ones that I liked the most.
And I loved the all teal, like of the first Marlins game, Charlie Huff complete game victory, solid teal hat was a good Marlins look, obviously.
Right, they leaned all the way into the teal, and
that was such a 90s thing. Like because it was like the Charlotte Hornets are selling all these jerseys or whatever, and it's like, oh, we got to go teal, and it was so of the moment that within like 5 years it looked ridiculous, and that now it's got like a retro appeal. Like, remember when this was the color?
Yeah, I've actually been in the market for the all teal Marlins hat, but have not. You know, it's difficult to find. You can find like the black one with the teal brim, but it's difficult to find the full 100% teal Marlins hat.
It's frustrating that not every single hat that every team has ever played in is readily available at my fingertips. I've had so many frustrations with hat purchases. Like I know the hat I want, just how can I not have it? And you can't have it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We will move on. Matt Harvey returned to Citi Field. The Mets, I guess you could say like the Mets don't score runs for Jacob DeGrom. They did score runs for Matt Harvey on Wednesday, but I think, bigger than the outcome was the reception he got, which entering the game, I think anyone could have said it's like a sort of a coin toss, like trying to guess the whims of the crowd on a guy like Harvey after the tenure he had in Flushing. But I thought it was very nice to see them greet him very warmly.
Yeah, I thought going in that it would probably be more positive than negative, but I expected some boos. And I didn't hear any at the game Wednesday. It seemed universally positive. And I was surprised that, you know, it was... There was an ovation when he took the mound in the bottom of the first. There was another when he came up to bat in the top of the second, and then a third when he left the game in the fifth inning. That it was as consistent as it was, because it reminded me of when other guys have come back to Shea Stadium or Citi Field, who had much longer and much less complicated tenures with the Mets. You know, Mike Piazza coming back as a Padre and getting a lot of ovations. You know, the intensity of it is different because it's a Wednesday noontime start, which, obviously, like, the Mets could not draw that up. But it's like you could have misread bad intentions into the Mets if they could have just made like, oh, Matt Harvey's coming back. Yeah, we're going to play that game at noon. We're going to make sure there's the fewest amount of people in there as possible. And you know, you're playing in front of 8,000 fans instead of 30,000. It was nice to hear that reception. Because, you know, when he came back in 2018 with the Reds, it was far more mixed. It was probably slightly more negative than positive. So it shows you how time has changed the fans' perception. And I think Harvey's perception himself. I didn't get to cover him much. I started covering the team in 2018. So I really only had a spring training in a month with him. Mm-hmm. And at that point, his relationship with the media was, I think it'd be polite to call it strained. After the game... yesterday or Wednesday, I wasn't sure exactly what to expect from him. And that was, you know, he was genuine. He was candid. He seemed reflective. Like, that was probably as good as he's been in a media session in a long time. And as upfront as he's been with New York media in a long time. And it showed you, I thought, what it meant to him, that it was actually special. That, you know, he had said that he was holding back tears at certain parts of that game, because he wasn't sure himself what the reception would be like. And I think it's one of those that it kind of crystallizes what he meant to this team when there was not much to root for in 2012 and 2013, when it was, you know, this team was worth watching 1/5 of the time, and it was because of Matt Harvey, and that, you know, a fan base that maybe took him for granted by the time things were going south for him after 2015, and for a player who maybe took that fan base for granted himself at that point, that there's kind of a renewed appreciation for what they meant to each other.
Do you know who was the interviewer in Matt Harvey's first on-camera interview at his first spring training?
Was it Ted Berg?
It was Ted Berg. I did that. It was when I was at SMY. We always did a lot of prospect stuff. We went over to the minor league side. I think Jay hooked it up, got us Matt Harvey to interview, and he was great. And he was, you know, I remember thinking at the time, like, wow, this guy can, like, he'll really talk to you. Like, he gave some pretty good, like, candid answers. And then when the camera went off, he was like, how'd I do? And it was so disarming, you know, like, and part of that is just, you're talking to a minor leaguer can often be different than talking to major leaguers who have a little more confidence and a little more media training. But this was at a time when the Mets had, like just that week been conducting media training with their minor leaguers, and it was clearly on his mind. And we're like, you did great, man. Like, it was, you know, that was fantastic. And it was funny to sort of watch that progression from, like, this guy who's from the start sort of hyper aware of his own image, and then how you know, it's like it's almost Shakespearean with Matt Harvey, like how he rose to the challenge of being an ace for the Mets. You know, despite there were doubts the week he came up that he would be a good major league starter. Adam Rubin quoted a scout that said he's Pelfrey without the curve, which is just an insane comparison, because Mike Pelfrey didn't even have a curve. And then for Harvey to be so good and then just become this, really, in a way, Jacob DeGrom hasn't even, you know, Harvey just became this sort of transcendent figure in New York sports for a little while. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, started the All-Star game. He was just like the guy, and it felt so very much like you could just see what was going to happen. Like, it was all just felt inevitable from the time it became clear that Matt Harvey was very good. It just felt like he knew how it was going to end. Maybe you didn't think it was going to end so quickly, but you could see he was buying into the hype. You could see he was taking things for granted, as you mentioned, and then it made the downfall, while predictable, perhaps like that much more agonizing, that it was like, oh, like anyone could have seen this coming. I don't know. It makes me feel good to see him seem like he's contrite, like he really has learned a thing or two and been humbled quite a bit. And it makes me glad to see that he's still pitching and, you know, to some extent pitching effectively in the major leagues. Obviously, it's not the career he thought he would have as of 2013 or 2015, but it's a major league career nonetheless, and that's an impressive thing. And he's made tons of money, and, you know, he's learned tons of lessons, and it seems like he's going to be okay.
So I have a question for you and for the Mets fan base broader terms, but you're the one who has a microphone. How much do you think it's easier for Mets fans to swallow Matt Harvey's downfall, like that he did not become for years the guy you thought he would be an established ace for this team for a very long time? Is it easier to come to terms with that because some other guy who didn't have those expectations on that same team has become everything you would have thought Matt Harvey would be in Jacob DeGrom? Like, that, if you had told a Mets fan in 2015, like, yeah, I mean, you guys, the Mets are going to have the best pitcher in baseball in 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021. You'd be like, oh yeah, probably Matt Harvey. Instead, it is DeGrom. And I my feeling is that, you know, it's a lot easier for Mets fans to be okay that it didn't work out for the guy they had all these expectations for, because they were fulfilled by someone else.
I think that is absolutely correct, right? Because I don't feel the same way necessarily. I mean, I don't have any reason to, like, hate Paul Wilson, But like I, you know, like, and obviously Paul Wilson never got to the Matt Harvey heights, and neither did Bill Pulsifer or Jason Isringhausen. But I think the sting of Generation K's failure with the Mets, Isringhausen went on to a really nice major league career and wound up coming back with the Mets, but certainly wasn't the star of the Mets that we thought he would be with the Mets. Generation K still, like, how much hopes I had for that still acts upon my heart and soul a little bit. But I think maybe it's adulthood for me, but I think the fact that DeGrom is DeGrom and that you got this, you know, like, okay, you thought it would be Harvey and it turned out to be DeGrom, but one of these guys. And remember in 2015, it was Madsen Wheeler too. And it seemed like, okay, this is it. The Mets are going to just keep making the World Series now because they have these four incredible young starting pitchers. And obviously it didn't shake out that way for Mats either. Wheeler's been real good, but yeah, I think that having DeGrom and seeing DeGrom and getting to watch DeGrom play every 5 days just cures a whole lot of potential resentment.
So Bobby Jones' All-Star appearance did not.
Oh, I was such a big Bobby Jones fan. I
didn't heal the Generation K wounds.
True story. So I went to Tom Seaver's Hall of Fame induction, and back then they used to play the Hall of Fame game. They would play an exhibition game between an NL team and an American League team, which was a novelty because it was before interleague play. They would play an exhibition game on tiny little Doubleday Field in Cooperstown. I think now they have minor league teams play it, but that year it was the big league Mets and the big league White Sox, who had a good lineup. They had Steve Sachs and Frank Thomas and George Bell, and I think Robin Ventura. Like they were a good team, and because they weren't going to waste a starter, the Mets had Bobby Jones come up from Binghamton, and Bobby Jones threw six no-hit innings in that game. And I was like, this is it. This is the new, because I believe he was from Fresno, just like Tom Seaver. And so it was like, this is it. Here comes Tom Seaver. And so I have very warm feelings in my heart forever for Bobby Jones. He threw that, what was it? Was it in game 163 or was it a playoff game when he threw a one hitter?
Game four of the 2000 division series against the Giants.
That's right. Yeah. So I know Bobby Jones can do no wrong with me.
Yeah, I remember. I think it was 97. He made the All-Star team, and like that was when the first time the Mets were good during my lifetime. Really, well, during my like formative, you know, I could remember they were good in 1986, but I was 6 days old. So I remember following along in the newspaper to see like to make sure that Bobby Jones was still the wins leader in the National League the way he was for most of the first half of that season.
And then you never know if Mark Clark is going to overtake him.
Mark Clark, did he ever start opening day, Mark Clark, for the Mets? Or?
There was one season when he was definitely their best pitcher, but I don't know if he wound up their opening day starter the next year or not.
Yeah, 96, he went 14-11 with a 3.43 ERA. I mean, Mark Clark had a pretty good, Mark Clark's ERA plus with the New York Mets.
How do you name your kid Mark? I'm sorry. Like, I'm sorry if he's out there listening or anyone with a similarly rhyming name is, but. When your last name is Clark, do you really think Mark? I don't know. Like that's, I spent so much time thinking with my kids about like, how could this be turned to make fun of the kid? You can't name your kid Tim if your last name is Berg, because then every time he falls, everybody yells Tim Berg, right? So like we thought this all through. But like Mark Clark, you just let Mark Clark slip past the goalie.
Mark Clark's ERA plus with the New York Mets is better than Matt Harvey's, by the way.
I buy that. Mark Clark was really good for the Mets. I could talk mid to late 90s Mets pitching all day long. Like if you want to get to Reed Cornelius, we certainly can.
No, we'll skip that one.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
We got a question from the email, which I am pulling up, and it comes from Adam. Adam wants to know, He says he's a big fan of the podcast, which we appreciate. Said, I've always wondered whether a team's TV or radio analysts ever provide advice to the players or coaches. In particular, it seems like Ron and Keith always have great observations on the SNY broadcasts. Would they ever see something that the coaches miss?
I think those guys do provide advice. Probably Hernandez, mm-hmm. I think, talks about it more openly than Darling does. And I'm not sure it's like things the coaches miss, you know, like Hernandez might be pointing out something that the hitting coaches or pitching, you know, or Darling is pointing out something the pitching coaches have been harping on with a guy. You just haven't heard that coach talk about it on air or something. And I think Hernandez mostly, like, the bulk of his work is probably talking about first base defense.
Right.
With someone like Pete Alonso and going over different things there. And that's, I mean, that is because he was probably the best ever. I don't know who the guy. I don't know.
It's him. Like, I think if you look up, like, at least, and defensive metrics obviously on historical players are leave a lot to be desired. But I believe if you look it up, and I think by reputation too, Keith Hernandez is just like head and shoulders the best first base defenseman in baseball history.
Yeah, like I don't know who's hearing that and getting hot in the collar that they're not being mentioned. So I think that's where he comes in, and like that is an area where, you know, Gary DeSarcina is the Mets infield coach, but you know, you're going to kind of defer to Keith Hernandez. When it comes to first base defense. So I think that's, you know, like, you don't see him, he's not like in a uniform out on the field in spring training going over things with him the way that, like, you know, Mike Piazza shows up for a day in a uniform and kind of, you know, talks to the catchers and gets the old feeling back. Hernandez doesn't do that. But he does chat with guys like Alonso and Dom Smith about different ways of playing the position, different approaches to certain aspects of it, and what he sees when he does watch them play. So I think there is some element to that, but it's probably not a major one outside of, I think, that one specific area.
So total zone runs, which only go back to 1953 and are an estimate. By that stat, among first basemen, Hernandez is way out in front with 120 total zone runs saved. Next best is Todd Helton with 106. Behind Helton is Adrian Gonzalez with 99 and John Olerud with 95. So three of the top four first basemen in baseball history, or at least since 1953, have been Mets at some point, but Hernandez is, you know, he's the guy in terms of defensive first baseman. So I think, you know, even because my guess would be that Keith and Ron would feel concerned about stepping on toes, right? And so, like you mentioned, like, if it's something where they can confirm or emphasize something a coach might be working with a player on, then I'm sure they're glad to do it. But I think you wouldn't want to risk saying anything that defies what a coach might say. And so it's got to be a delicate thing, but no one knows more about first base defense than Keith Hernandez does. Like, no one in the world.
Yeah. So it's, well, you don't want too many voices in a player's head. So you kind of stick to what you know best. And there's no one who knows playing first base better than Keith.
And I'm sure he would be happy to talk to players about the Civil War too, if that came up.
Yeah. I mean, he has such and jazz and, basically anything that they could possibly want to know, I'm sure Keith has some background knowledge in.
I always at SNY, like, campaigned when we were trying to come up with web video ideas. I just wanted one to be Keith Hernandez reading poetry with, like, no context whatsoever. And I don't think anyone ever went to him with that, because I just got, like, shot down immediately. I maintain that would have been a viral hit.
That should be... you know, obviously the late inning baseball cards are terrific, but they should every once in a while, maybe if it's, you know, a West Coast late night game where it's a blowout, you turn to, instead of pulling out baseball cards, you pull out some Wordsworth.
I would say that there's like a 0% chance that Keith Hernandez does not have like a list of 8 to 10 favorite poems.
And
I want to hear him read them.
He's a Walt Whitman guy. Leaves of Grass.
I don't know enough poetry to really try to even guess. But, you know, maybe, like, even who knows? Maybe he spans all eras. Maybe not just like a a fan of the classical poetic form, but someone who can get down on some more modern contemporary poetry forms as well. I don't know. We would have to ask him. We should say also that this year, probably, presumably, there's a lot less advice going back and forth between the broadcast booth and the team, because the broadcasters are not traveling with the team. And it is, as you've mentioned before, while traveling with the team, while on the road, that you wind up getting much better access to the players on the Mets.
Yeah, and I actually thought it was interesting. On Wednesday's broadcast, I had actually asked Luis Rojas before the game about Jonathan Villar's base running. And Rojas made a point that I had not realized, and that Gary Cohen on the broadcast pointed out he had not realized, and it's because of our distance from the players, is how big Jonathan Villar is. That Villar is like 6'2 and 230 pounds.
Really?
Yeah, which it doesn't, you know, you don't quite
he
get
looks
that.
Like a I would have guessed him at like 5'9, 190. He's like a stocky guy. He looks stocky. He doesn't look like an NFL running back though.
Right, but that is how big he is, and it's just something you don't, you know, because we're not in the clubhouse and you don't stand next to him, and you know, you see him at the plate standing next to a catcher who's usually big, or at first base standing next to a large first baseman, you really don't get a sense for how big he is as a player, and so how remarkable his speed is for a man his size, that he is more of like a wide receiver, a big wide receiver, or a linebacker even. Who can move. And so that was like, I had not realized that. And Gary had mentioned, you know, because we're not in the clubhouse, you know, you couldn't quite grasp that until you actually hear it from Rojas.
And I would not have guessed for sure that Jonathan Villar was that big. We have so many things to learn about the Mets, and we will continue to learn and discuss them here on the Metrospective. If you have a question for the podcast, please do email us. You can email me at asktedberg@gmail.com. You can also get at Tim or myself on Twitter. He is at Tim Britton. I am at OG Ted Berg. Please, if you're enjoying the show, rate, review, subscribe on iTunes or Spotify or anywhere you can do those things with podcasts. Tim, the Mets have a weekend full of games to play, and we will be back soon to discuss them.
Yeah, you've got Tampa Bay in St. Petersburg. Tyler Glasnow on Friday night. That should be a challenge for the offense. We'll see if they can carry over the momentum. And I'm interested in seeing how the Mets perform against some left-handed pitching, because I think they're going to get Shane McClanahan. I think they'll probably see Ryan Yarbrough as a bulk guy over the weekend. The Mets have not seen a lot of left-handed pitching. They've done okay against it so far, even if they're not winning those games as often. You know, they came back against Means and Baltimore on Tuesday, but that's what I'm looking out for, is how does this offense, which is left-handed heavy, perform against some pretty good left-handed pitching.
And it's always a challenge facing the Rays, because you kind of never know what they're going to throw at you.
Right. You know, they've got the relief clock that we saw last year of deliveries from everywhere from 9 to 3 o'clock. So we'll see how that goes.
And we will, of course, be back to talk about it. Tim, peace out.
Adios.